Hello, you're listening to The Bookworm, presented to you in association with Starburst Magazine and live on fabradiointernational.com. I'm your host, Ed Fortune, and I'm here with...
Producer Al.
And it's just the pair of us again. Everyone else is away on exciting adventures, as per usual.
Mostly with their mothers. Happy Mother's Day, UK only.
We are recording during Mother's Day, so hello and happy Mother's Day to all the mothers who are listening, no matter what you may be. I will be
book
doing
news?
An absolute pile of book reviews, and I have... Let's see. I have 365 Doctor Who, 365 Days of Memorable Moments and Impossible Things. I have The Firefly, the Gorham Shiniest Dictionary and Facebook in the Verse. We also have Where's the Wookiee? Where's Wookiee? She said, and smiled in a special way. Where's Wookiee? She said. We know she loves you. Yes, that makes no sense to anyone, doesn't it? I'm just babbling at this point. We will also be talking about with a voice that is still confused. With a voice that is often still confused, but is becoming ever louder, or something along those lines. But firstly, let's get to some book news.
The world 24 hours a day. This is FanRadio International.
So we have a date for Alan Moore's self-shattering novel Jerusalem.
It's a very heavy book, that's why it's shelf-shattering.
It's a very heavy book, it's a million words long.
Wow, that is quite long. No more than three letters.
It could be a recipe for pie repeated several thousand times.
Yes,
It's not. It sounds interesting.
That sounds like a qualified interesting.
Yeah. Chapters are inspired by the likes of James Joyce, Samuel Beckett and Enid Blyton. That's an eclectic mix, I think you'll find. That's an interesting combination. James Joyce and Enid Blyton. Apparently the Enid Blyton section is a savage parody / pastiche of Enid Blyton, whereas the James Joyce stuff is apparently pretty much the entire novel. It seems to be a kind of run-on consciousness sort of thing. Moore seems to...
He can just get anything published, can't he?
He can. This has been published by Top Shelf, who have printed a whole bunch of stuff from his in the past.
Right.
They did, I might be wrong, but they did From Hell, for example.
Okay.
Moore's kind of, he doesn't really trust a lot of the mainstream publishers, with good reason.
Yeah, yeah.
He's still not had the full rights from various works that he's done in the past.
But isn't that because he didn't take the advice of a lawyer, because he didn't want to pay them?
Short version, yes. Longer version.
Hey, lawyer chaps, in the long term it'll cost you less money.
There's a whole show we could do about the legal ins and outs and who to blame and all the rest of the rights of the author, but Moore's always been notoriously prickly about trying to sort himself out with these sort of things. And then you look at other people who've been very kind of slick and, you know, on the ball with this sort of thing, and they've just gotten a lawyer and gotten the contract.
Yeah.
Going on a tangent here, but if you are getting into the writing game, there's a book called How the Writer Got Screwed, which you should absolutely read. Jerusalem finally has a date. It's coming out on Top Shelf in September 2016. We predict that it's going to sell like hotcakes and then sit on people's shelves gathering dust. I think a lot of people are going to read the first chapter, and then I think they're going to get bored, to be honest. I've read Voices in the Fire. I love Voices in the Fire. It's a great book. It's really involved and really kind of deep. But this reading should not be an endurance test.
And according to this Guardian article I just found, if it's coming out in the autumn, it's at least 6 months later than it was supposed to be.
Well, it's always, you know, he's always was going to take his time on this.
Right. Anyway. Is he doing a George R.R.?
He's doing a James Joyce.
Ah.
Or a Philip K. Dick, in fairness. Mm. I think he's probably going to be easier. I think he wants to be compared to James Joyce from the excerpts that we've seen.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of mention of Joyce in the blurb, the press blurb.
From the excerpts that I've seen, to be honest, I think it's going to be closer to later Philip K. Dick.
Mm.
In that sort of, you know, dreamlike, weird, existential. Have you just read the extract?
The author told the New Statesman that there would be a Lucia Joyce chapter, which is completely incomprehensible, all written in a completely invented sub-Joycean text. I just want to read a book and be entertained. I don't want to feel like I'm an English lit when I'm a Philadelphia senior school.
The thing is that Moore's actually quite bad at inventing language.
Right.
If you've read Across 100 Years, which I think we've talked about on the show in the past, he's actually... Ballad of Halo Jones is another good example. He's actually quite... It doesn't feel natural, and it doesn't feel natural because he's made it all up himself, if you see what I mean. So it probably sounds natural to him, but that's not how you invent a language. Mm. Especially if you're inventing a slang or a patois, you normally base it on something else that has naturally evolved, so it feels natural. There's some really nice bits in Ballad of Halo Jones that really works, but some of the stuff, like describing things as hoop party when they mean it's really good. And it's like, yeah, that works in context, but you would never actually say that because the words are too harsh. It doesn't quite work. He's always loved the idea of inventing languages, but we'll see. Well, let's not judge a book before it comes out.
We always judge a book before it comes out. It's the entire point of this show.
Yeah, that's a fair point, actually. Normally, we've read it, though.
We also judge books by their covers.
We'll get to that point in a moment. Sad news, Samhain Publishing has closed. It's an American company, so is it Samhain or Samhain? Do we care?
Maybe it's Samhain.
Samhain. It's spelled...
But in something that approaches an American accent, it's whatever you and I just did.
It's spelled Samhain. Let's not do bad American accents. Let's
I don't
not.
Know, are you in any way annoyed of Americans doing bad Newcastle accents this weekend?
I might be a little bit. I might be a little bit. This is totally nothing to do with Brit News, but if you're a fan of
No,
TV
that
show,
man's a published author. New York Times bestseller.
It's a good point,
and published
actually.
By a genre publisher in this country.
He is. So Castle, a TV show. We've gone on a total tangent. Castle is a TV show about the detective adventures of a fictional author called Richard Castle, played by Nathan Fillion. They recently had a guy called, I believe he's called Greg Byrne, which is unfortunate, because I think there's a more famous Greg Byrne out there, but never mind. Who is an LA-based actor who was to play Geordie, apparently. A Geordie who has hit his head walking up an island and gone to the the Dick Van Dyke School of Accent Training. It sounds nothing like anything ever.
It's nothing from the northeast of England, I'll tell you that.
And to make matters worse, they use these kind of little Irish pipes to do the interlude when he turns up. You know, that kind of, this is a comedy character, laugh at the comedy Geordie. That's fine, you know. It's not as if the...
Top of the morning to you.
Oh, my goodness. It's just, you can find it on the YouTube. But oh, my goodness. Goodness me. We've gone on a total tangent here. But apparently he was stitched up by his voice coach, according to sources.
Yeah.
It sounds like a convenient excuse. Yeah. He is good friends with the guy who plays Ryan, who, you know, does a fake Irish accent. So there's
The guy who plays Ryan, he does a fake Irish accent occasionally, and he is genuinely ancestrally Irish. And I think, you know, his family's about first or second generation, so...
Yeah, I'm still allowed to be horrendous. It's just awful. The Irish pipes thing, I think, is the thing that just tells you they've not even bothered to do any research. It's not as if the North East doesn't have its own musical style, or its own cuisine, or its own accent, or all the rest of it. It's the fact that we're also presented as incomprehensible, which, you know,
To be fair... Mr. Fortune, on weekends when you've been home and seen your family, it is incomprehensible for a few days. We try and have production meetings, it fails.
I'm going to go on a total tangent here, but I think if you want to claim to be a member, you know, the United Kingdom, then one of the things you have to learn is you have to learn to understand that you are in a country with lots of different voices, literally lots of different voices, lots of different languages, well, some different languages, but mostly take the time to learn how different people speak and respect them. Basically, it's not hard. But I've gone on a total tangent because, you know, that's very, very, very vaguely related to books, let's be honest. So back to Samhain Publishing, that's closed. Mm-hmm. There was a small press title that boasted New York Times bestselling authors such as Maya Banks and Lauren Dane. And it's published horror, fantasy and science fiction. Mostly it published romance. It used to do like sci-fi romance and horror romance and all the rest of it, but it did all points of romance, shall we say. The company will continue to process royalties for some time, but it's in the process of winding down. Essentially, it's kind of sad news for a lot of, because it was a good jumping off point. In the same way that, you know, small press companies like Fox Spirit Books and Newcon Press and this sort of thing, and Telos Publishing to an extent, or Telos Publishing would tell us that they're a medium-sized press. Whatever, those slightly, you know, the non-big five, non-mainstream publishers that will take the risk on your talent and get you started. It's always sad when you see one of those goals, and as I understand it, Samhain were one of the good ones. So where else are we going with this? There's been an absolute pile of shortlists announced for various awards.
Oh, there's the Clark thing, like if you've got a long commute tomorrow morning, then read the Clark long list, short list. It goes on forever.
It's the Clark submissions list.
Right.
So what's happened with the Clark Awards is they've had 113 books from 41 publishers have been submitted. It's really, really long. If we desperately need filler towards the end of the show, we can go through some of them. I don't think we're going to have any problems with that. You know how we were talking about Alan Moore just a moment ago?
Yeah.
The Horror Writers Association.
Yeah. Oh, who are
doing the Bram Stoker Awards. Mm. The Horror Writers Association are going to honour Alan Moore and George A. Romero with prestigious Lifetime Achievement Awards at their next at the StokerCon, which will be in Las Vegas later this year. If, by the way, you are a passing millionaire philanthropist and you want to send us to Las Vegas to cover this,
Vegas baby,
then we'd happily do that. If you'd rather just laugh at us, you can contact us on social media via Twitter, Facebook and Tumblr. We are Radio Bookworm on all of those formats, at Radio Bookworm, / Radio Bookworm, Google search Radio Bookworm, Radio Bookworm, until we change our name to brief new words. Let's see what else
Which
is going
already
on.
Already has an Instagram. It's very exciting.
It's a very exciting Instagram. We'll talk about that in a moment, actually.
We should mention Eastercon.
We should. We really should. Talking about Eastercon, actually, there will be a bunch of awards happening there. So the
and most of the team will be there at one point or another.
Yes.
Special appearance by Ross.
We will have a Ross Smith. Mm. We will have a...
Is Nympha there?
We might have a Nympha, depending on circumstances. I don't think we have Adele. I don't think we have a Psy. We might do, but we'll be there.
Yeah. Well, it depends. It depends on what happens with these various panels that we're on.
There's a lot of panels. Mm-hmm. There's an awful lot of panels. So, the British Science Fiction Association, which normally do their things at Eastercon, have announced its shortlist for Best Novel. The Best Novel shortlist is Europe at Midnight by Dave Hutchinson. Mm-hmm. I really like Europe at Midnight. I didn't like the first one, I like the second one. Chris Beckett's Mother of Eden. Elliot de Boudard's The House of Shattered Wings. Ian MacDonald's Lunar New Moon and Justina Robson's Glorious Angels. There's stuff for best short story, best art and best non-fiction as well. One of the things that Eastercon does is it does non-fiction. It has an entire actual science track. One of its guests is David Clements.
who is a lecturer and sci-fi fan. So that should be jolly interesting. We'll try and also catch up with Sarah Pindra if we get him.
Yay! We like Sarah.
We do like Sarah, because she writes amazing books and she's hilarious. Let's see. Talking about sci-fi awards, the Nebula Award nominees have also been announced.
It is very much award season, isn't it?
It is very much award season. The Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America have announced their Nobulas. Nebulas. Oops. The Nebula Awards. Sorry, gentle listener, I appear to have killed producer Alan. I haven't done that, officer, honest. Let's see what's going on with the Nobulas. The Nebula Awards, the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. Let's see. So they also do a whole bunch of awards. You can find out the whole details. We'll just quickly go through the best novel shortlist. Raising Kane by Charles E. Gannon's on there. That's a Bane book. The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemison is on there. Ancillary Mercy by Anne Leckie. Do we think Ancillary Mercy is going to win?
I honestly have no clue. You know, the British ones, I voted in those, and I, at this point, could not tell you who I voted for in any category.
Okay. See, this is why you're the producer and the guy who reads all the books, because I can tell you about every single book that is.
Yeah, I sort of went down and went, ooh, who'd be featured on the show? I'll vote for them.
Okay. Well, it's good that my recommendations are getting to someone. So Fran Wilde's Updraft, good luck to Fran. Basque, The Elephant's Graveyard, I know nothing about, actually. Uprooted by Nomi Novik as well. That could win. I suspect it's going to be Ancillary Mercy.
The point of the shortlist is they all could win, couldn't it?
Yeah, the one that excites me, always excites me, is The Kitschies.
Get your phone to do something exciting. Sorry.
Let's see, on to The Kitschies.
This is a lot of awards all at the same time, and some of them appear to have very similar categories and nominations.
They are. I mean, there's quite a N.K. Jemison is yet again in on the Kitschies shortlist there. So let's see, we've got The Heart Goes Last by Margaret Atwood for Bloomsbury. We've got Europe at Midnight again by Dave Hutchinson. He's got to win something, surely.
Yeah, you don't.
Come on, Dave. The Reflection by Hugo Wilkin, which is okay, I've not heard. Again, The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemison. And The Thing Itself by Adam Roberts. I want Adam Roberts to win something. I like Adam Roberts. He's very dapper.
We've met him, haven't we?
Yeah. We've reviewed about three of his books so far. We've definitely done Jack Glass. We've done Adam Robots as well, which is a collection of short stories. I think we did Betty.
Yes,
the one about the talking cow. I'm pretty sure we did. We didn't do Board of the Rings, which was one of the very early ones.
Oh, that's how I know the guy.
But it's that guy. We were talking about him last night at the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy party.
We were.
Steven Steen.
Hey, what's up? This is Matt Stryker.
It's the Psycho Shooter himself, Drake Younger.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Adam Cole, and you're listening to the Sunday Falsies.
The Sunday Falsies is your weekly dose of pro wrestling from the UK and all over the world. Join Craig and Gaz every Sunday, 3 till 5, right here on Fab Radio International.
Enjoy, and we'll see you front row.
Whether you're an acoustic virtuoso or a rock god, Fab Music Store. At Fab, we buy and sell new and used kit with guitar brands like Faith, Breedlove, Lag and Westfield, and Dynacord and Electro Voice sound systems. We hire sound systems from £60 and have guitars for sale from £39.99. With ukuleles, banjos and all the lights, leads, stands and mixers you can imagine. For sales, hire and service, Fab Music Store. Little Underbank, Stockport. Visit fabmusicstore.co.uk.
So according to this book I have in my hand,
Yen
Hu Zibi Adua Shi means engage in a fishes hurling contest with a monkey.
Right. That's helpful for ideology to have in your back pocket.
Yeah, not as useful as Mian Mian Adia Men Lian Zhong Jian. I'm not going to go through it.
You know what? I'm going to just speculate that your pronunciation might be off a tad.
It might be. It might be very much. I can't actually use half of these because they're very, very filthy. And my pronunciation, I believe, would be Giao Shi. I've got in my hands the Firefly, the Goram Shiniest Dictionary and Facebook in the Verse, produced by Titan Books. It's one of those. So we'll start. Let's get over the whole thing that it's clearly a tie-in book for a TV show that's never coming back.
Too soon.
And, you know, it's a lovely brown hardback as well. It's not covered.
It looks gorgeous.
It's not covered in gore because it hasn't been run through the wash.
Too soon.
And let's get into what this actually is. So it's a universe book. It's a book that tells you everything about the universe itself. In the form of a dictionary in Facebook. So in the back, we've got all of the... If you don't know the TV show Firefly, if you've not seen the TV show Firefly, then you should tweet this and then we can laugh at you. We're on at Radio Bookworm in Twitter.
To be fair, it took me some time to see Firefly.
Yeah, in fairness, it's one of those shows that I think...
Because, you know, there's only 12 episodes, whatever it is.
And after the initial kind of launch of it as well, I think a lot of people have come to it over the years.
Mm.
If you see what I mean. It's one of those things that I think, you know... partners, lovers, friends and all the rest of it, grab their other friends and go, look, you've not seen this. It's like you've not seen Star Wars, isn't it? You've not seen Firefly? Oh, you need to watch Firefly. It's that sort of... And because there's only 12 episodes, it's not like me saying, Producer Al, you should watch Babylon 5. There's only 200 episodes.
No.
Exactly. I think there might be 100, actually, but still. You know, there's a lot of Babylon 5. Whereas 12 episodes of Firefly, you can do on a weekend, no problem. So if you don't know Firefly, it's a cowboy western in space TV show. Everyone has run over to... basically, humanity has moved to another part of the galaxy after the Earth that was has fallen apart. You know, and now we have, essentially, it is the Wild West in space.
It is.
So we focus on the crew of the Serenity, which is a spaceship that's working on the fringes of the galaxy, doing jobs, being a bit parody, being a bit roguish and all the rest of it. And the characters include, a fun-loving, life-affirming engineer, a sarcastic pilot, the ship's captain, who is an ex-military war hero style guy who just wants to be free, his brave lieutenant, and many other characters who are all equally charming, produced by Josh Whedon. So, is the book itself any good? Well, this is a guidebook. This tells you everything that you need to know about the show, and also in the form of an ABC. It literally is the ABC of Firefly. So if we flip randomly to a page, in the A section, it'll tell us about Ariel City, which is a place where they visit once, the episode Ariel, and it gives you a couple of paragraphs about what's important about there. It also then tells you what an asteroid belt is, just in case you don't know.
So it's got actual science in it?
It's just a short explanation as to what an asteroid belt is. There's a definition of boat, because boat is used slightly differently in the show, because they call the ship a boat.
They do.
They define a body bag as an aluminium coffin-like case that contains the body of a corpse, which again is what a body bag is in the Firefly universe. So this isn't just a guidebook and dictionary. This is very specified too. They use this phrase "born tired" in the show. I am born tired, and it's in this. This book gives you the meaning of the phrase "born tired." It means really tired. Now I found that a bit weird because obviously it's a term I use all the time. Well, not all the time, because I'm not always born tired, but, you know. And I was sitting there thinking, did I get that term from Firefly? And it's like, no, I got that term from my dad. You know, but it might be foreign to some people. And talking about foreign, they do a big breakdown of... And they speak Mandarin in the show, because it's Chinese-American
Chinese English Speaking Alliance, who come over to this part of the verse. So they tend to swear in Chinese and also say terms of affection. So, you know, it's things like my dear sister, my dear little sister, and, you know, watch out and all the rest of it. It's quite cleverly done. It's one of those ways that you get, one of the ways you build a universe is by using language properly. We were saying this at the top of the show. It's one of the things I don't think Alan Moore does very well. Is I really don't think he does. He doesn't use language effectively. When it comes to slang, he writes some beautiful words. Don't get me wrong, and he tells some beautiful stories. But when he's talking, when he's creating words in a world to bring you into that world, it's not a trick he's very good at. It's a trick that Dan Abnett's very good at. It's a trick that Neil Gaiman's very good at.
It's very easy to get it wrong, though, isn't it?
It's very easy to get it wrong. It's a good trick as well. And it's something that Firefly does brilliantly, is it just uses these non-alienating, fairly easy to understand turns of phrases, like shiny.
Yeah.
Shiny means okay. It's shiny. How's it going? It's shiny. Everything's okay. You get that straight away. You can pretty much pick up what that means. Because you know what the word shiny normally means, and someone's just described themselves as shiny. Brilliant.
That's just the development of language, really, isn't it?
Well, that's how you do. But that's how you kind of bring that. By putting the Chinese in, you're bringing the world in and making it slightly different and slightly sci-fi, essentially. You don't have to invent words, you just have to use them differently, or you just have to make them obvious. Firefly, the Gorham Shiniest Dictionary and Facebook in the Verse. Great fun. Enjoyed it immensely. Get it to give to your Firefly fan and your family, or for yourself if you're a Firefly fan. We're going to go through a bunch of these.
Also, Babylon 5 has 110 episodes and 6 TV films.
Yeah, I wouldn't put you through the TV films, in fairness.
Thanks.
No, absolutely you wouldn't. But no. Oh my goodness, there are some absolutely beautiful, beautiful episodes in there. And some great turns of phrase. But, anyway, and obviously there's a whole thing about Babylon 5, which I'll talk about at some other point, because there's a lovely little speech there that means an awful lot to me. Shall I go on to where?
Yes.
Shall I go
talk
on?
About a book?
Go on to Where's the Wookiee?
Where's Wookiee?
Where's the Wookiee? So, we know Where's Wally, yeah? Everyone knows Where's Wally? Are we all
if you're American, that is Where's Waldo.
Right, we're on the right page, though. It's, you know, this little Sunderland
red
supporter.
Stripes,
yeah. Sunderland is a football team. They wear red and white, in case you get it. It's a little Sunderland supporter wandering around. This big, big kind of detailed picture. This big crowded room. Same idea with Where's the Wookiee. It's Where's Wally, but with Chewbacca. We have scientifically tested this on small children, and it does get them curious and excited.
Yes.
Did you say
scientifically tested? We sat the child on a bench, opened the book in front of them, and started stopped watch timer thing going.
Lab coats.
Yeah.
Yes, anyway. Illustrations by Ulysses Farinas. Ulysses Farinas, you'll probably know from sci-fi comic books like Judge Dredd and Iron Man. He's the guy who does those incredibly detailed kind of pictures of spaceships and this sort of thing. And, you know, all the dirt is on them. And, you know, there's flocks of birds and all the little kind of engine relay and venting things are on there. And it's all really finely detailed.
Mm-hmm.
So he's doing the honours on Where's the Wookiee rather than the guy who does the Where's Wally's book, obviously. And it really, you know, it's a perfect fit. They've really picked someone who likes just drawing lots and lots of fine detail all the way across. So there's a lot for the eye to take in. And the idea of these books is obviously you look at them and you spend a good chunk of time just looking at the various
pictures.
I think
some of this is quite hard because I've had a look at this. Now, admittedly, I did open it onto the page that is entirely of Wookiees.
Certain Kashyyyk, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, which was probably not the best place to start, but it was like, I genuinely can't find the Wookiee.
But yeah, there's one that's set on Kashyyyk, which is the Wookiee home world. But there's another one that's an Imperial hangar, and it's just full of stormtroopers everywhere. And you think, well, surely I should be able to work out where Chewbacca is in a whole pile of stormtroopers. There's also, they do the thing like the Where's Wally book, where there's other characters for you to look at, so you can try and find out where Han Solo is, you can try and find out where Boba Fett is, you can try and find out where Greedo is. Mm-hmm. Spoilers, Greedo is almost certainly dead in Mos Eisley Cantina. But yes, Forlorm, IG-88, Bosk, Dengar, all of the bounty hunters are there. And there's obviously a key at the back to remind you to look for silly things and funny little things in case you've run out. So there's plenty to look at. This is primarily an art book. There's not much in the writing. And it'll take you, because it doesn't need to be, it explains to you what Jabba's Palace is, in case you don't know what Jabba's Palace is, tells you what the Death Star is, tells you what the Jedi Temple is, tells you what the Ewok Village is. Yes, there's an Ewok Village there. Try and find a Wookiee in an Ewok village, I dare you. There's the cantina, there's Echo Base. It's great fun. And again, something to keep a small child occupied.
There is a lot of Star Wars tie-in merch and various cross-platforming promotional sorts this time, isn't there?
Well,
now
yes,
that they are part of the House of Mouse.
Now that they're part of the House of Mouse.
Because we've had the colouring in book, which actually was quite good. It was a mindfulness colouring in book.
Yeah, I mean, we've not talked about
and
that.
And it was a proper mindfulness one.
We've not talked about that on the show, but the colouring in book, the Star Wars colouring in book, is really good because it's what they've done is they've taken, you know, there's a bit that's just like heads of stormtroopers.
Mm.
And you can just sit there and fill it in, but you've got what's called Princess Amidala with her incredible hair, and then her incredible hair goes all the way down, and then you get that kind of Rennie Macintosh style curly artwork, and you can just take your pens and colour it in. It's totally designed not for kids, you know. Obviously
well, most virtually all of them aren't they?
Well, the thing is, the Star Wars colouring in book, you'd think, well, it's just going to be pictures of R2-D2 for, you know, 6-year-olds colour in, but the mindfulness one is really, really well done. They've actually made it's what I'm really liking about the kind of uptick in Star Wars stuff at the moment is that the quality is there. It's like, yeah, okay, it's a Where's Wally rip off, but it looks brilliant. Oh yeah, it's colouring.
That's homage.
Sorry, you know, it's a colouring in book, but oh my goodness, they've gone for every level of, you know, of activity for the mind and that sort of thing. They've done really well with it. And finally, it's kind of a bit unfair to lump this in with the other two because it's something that stands out a little bit, and we reckon the 365 Days of Memorable Moments and Impossible Things by Justin Richards. So it's a day by day. Doctor Who's been running for over 50 years.
Yes.
And this is a day by day book. It's not a diary. It's a day book. So there's a mention every day that's connected to Doctor Who.
Right.
It's either an in-show event, it's normally an in-show event. Sometimes they'll talk about stuff that's to do with the production.
So what do you use it for if it's not a diary?
It's not a diary. It's a day-by-day book full of facts, essentially.
Show me.
This
is great radio.
It's fantastic radio. So, for example, 16th of January talks about Mike Yates when he appeared, and the fact that he's, you know, this unit agent who gets up to all sorts of shenanigans later on.
Oh, shenanigans. I see.
It's kind of like a detailed... It's essentially 365 things about Doctor Who.
So it's a little mini article to read per day, really, isn't it?
Yeah. It's you know, to be honest, if I had that... I mean, that's in a big kind of book sort of format.
Yes.
I'd kind of want that as one of those, you know, Tyree diary things.
Yeah.
Because those Tyree diary things were a little bit too short.
Mm-hmm.
I need, you know, I want 500 words. Or maybe 500 to 1,000 words. I want a short article on Doctor Who every day. As I can draw myself into. But it's also very well illustrated. It's a nice
book.
It's a nice shape and size as well. It's a nice weight to it. 11th of August, the movie Doctor Who. I remember being really excited on that day as well when it came out, and I was just like, yeah, no, unfortunately. But yes, it's
It's an interesting idea. I think it's the short version. I love the fact that on the 25th of December, the bit is Santa Claus saves the Doctor, and then you turn the page over, and it just goes through a huge list of potential things that happened on Christmas Day, because they've done so many Christmas stories, and it goes all the way back to 1965 and the Feast of Stephen.
Oh.
Which was arguably the first Christmas episode, because the Doctor turns around to the breaks the fourth wall.
He does break the fourth wall, yes.
Happy Christmas to all of you at home. Sort of thing.
They come very close to breaking the fourth wall on later occasions, don't they? But I think that's the blatant one.
But it's basically on this day in the Doctor Who universe, Sarah Jane Smith.
Aww.
Went and did a thing. On this day, the Doctor found himself in the Dalek Asylum. On this day, the Apollo 11 mission leaves Earth to make history, which obviously ties into the Doctor Who episode Day of the Moon. So it's a real historical event, because obviously they are historical stories in Doctor Who. We talked to Justin Richards last week, and he talked a lot about this book.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of fun with this, actually. It's an interesting one, because do you know what this book's really designed for?
Go on.
Sits in the toilet and you dive in, read a bit, and one of those other situations in your life where you need to wait. So it might sit on top of the microwave while you're, during that part of the day where you microwave your coffee. And you pull the book out and you kill a couple of minutes reading various bits and you put it down. It's not one of those books that I could do cover to cover for too long.
No, and the introduction does say that. The introduction says do not read all this in one go.
It isn't for that. It's for diving in for fun. It's odd to describe a book as the sort of book you read on the toilet, but it's the sort of book that you read, again, when you're waiting for something to happen, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite entertaining for that as well. Shall we get on with the interview?
Let's do it.
Across the world.
So we caught up with Antonia Honeywell. The quality on this recording is okay. It's not as brilliant as it normally is. We are working on improving that for you. But enjoy.
This is Fab Radio International.
Antonia Honeywell, welcome to the Bookworm.
Thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be here.
So tell us about the ship.
Well, the ship is a novel just pushing the envelope of where society is now, a little bit, turning the temperature up on the planet just a degree or two, giving the various crises that are going on in the world at the moment, just taking them a little bit further and imagining what London in particular would look like in those circumstances. And within that collapsing world, I created a man who has a huge, has created a lot of money for himself out of the collapse, as some people do when things are breaking down. And he wants to use that money to keep his daughter safe, to create a safe environment in which his daughter can grow up without worrying that she's going to be killed because she's holding a loaf of bread at a time when people are starving. And he does that by buying an enormous cruise ship, stocking it to the gills, not just with food, but with all the books, digital copies of all the books that have ever been published and the contents of all the museums and art galleries of the world. And he takes her along with 500 very carefully chosen people to form a society in which his daughter can grow up. but his fatal calculation, or the mistake he made in his calculations, is that he didn't handpick his own daughter. And she's got a lot of very difficult questions for him that he's simply not prepared to answer. So we're looking at a lot of things. We're looking at responsibility of the very wealthy in society, and at the idea of free will, really, within society, and where our responsibilities lie. That's kind of it.
Where does Lala come from in New York? Because she's very naive in many ways, and she's also very sharp in certain ways, and she's got a very interesting view compared to everyone else there. What experiences and what ideas did you draw on to create Lala?
Well, Lala is alone on the ship in that she's the only person who's been protected from the reality of the world they're escaping. And I think that's where her naivety comes from. I think you're going to have a very different point of view if you've seen someone murdered in front of you because they've got something that somebody else needs, than if you've had a very sheltered, safe life with enough to eat and not having gone through the deprivation and the dangers that everyone else on the ship has suffered. So I suppose I was looking at how we receive our information about the world in which we live. All of Lala's information about the world in which she lives has come from her father's interpretation of that world. The ship is her first opportunity to actually look at how the world around her is working and see what she thinks about it and where she finds herself in it. But at that point, her freedom's been taken away. So she's the character through which I'm exploring whether humanity wants safety or freedom, and that the two don't always go hand in hand. And when we live somewhere that it does, we're very lucky. But that's not the case for a lot of people. So it's all to do with kind of pushing the envelope of society and how we operate, just a little bit far. So that's where she came from in terms of theme and what I wanted to explore through the novel. But in terms of where she's coming from, in terms of my life experience, I didn't have a terribly privileged upbringing like she did, and I am fascinated by the way that you grow up and how you grow up affects your worldview as an adult, and obviously the way you then bring up your own children.
If you ever actually met Lala in, you know, some magical dreamscape,
yep,
what would you say to her?
It depends at which point in the story I met her. I think
answer.
If I met her at the beginning, I'd probably give her a good slap. I think if I met her towards the end, I've got a huge amount of admiration for what she does, and I don't want to spoil the story. But by the end of the novel, I think she's proven her worth quite exceptionally, and I'd be very, very proud of her if I met her towards the end. I think she makes decisions that most of us wouldn't, and I admire that.
In terms of literature, we've returned to dystopia with a bang. Why is that?
Sorry, I didn't quite get the question.
In terms of literature, dystopia, yeah, books are in. They are. Every other book that comes in at the moment is some dystopia or another at the moment.
Yeah, I think you've got a point there.
Why are we so fascinated with dystopic fictions?
I think we're going through a phenomenally interesting and quite frightening time, not just as a country, not just in Britain, but across the globe. I mean, there couldn't be much more frightening than the prospect of Donald Trump for American president. And he's actually getting further than any sane person ever thought he would. I think austerity is bringing about a rise in far-right views, looking for somebody to blame for, you know, the difficulties that people in society are going through at the moment. Like Nazi Germany, you know, Hitler was democratically elected. And I think I'm not saying we've gone that far, but I do think we're in a position where we're having to look very hard at what it means to be a human being, the planet is getting smaller. We can't ignore anymore that decisions that are taken in one country have repercussions elsewhere, all the way around the globe. The refugee crisis as well is something, it's happening in Calais, you know, it's a short hop across the English Channel. I think it's harder and harder, and with communications and technology, I think it's getting harder and harder to turn a blind eye to consequences and to some of the terrible things that are happening elsewhere on the planet. And I wonder whether that creates a fascination with speculative scenarios, you know, because they do seem quite relevant to where we are now.
In terms of your lighting, what's your next project?
Oh, that's an exceptionally good question. I've got two or three on the go at the moment, actually, and it will depend on what happens to the ship, how the ship's voyage goes, which one of those is the one that comes to the surface next. But very interesting time in that. I'm afraid that's all I can say about that at the moment.
Some light and frothy questions just to finish off, if you don't mind.
Yeah, not at all.
Firstly, if you find yourself trapped on a desert island, maybe you've escaped some sort of ship, we don't know. And you only have one book for company, what is that book?
Am I allowed the Bible and Complete Works of Shakespeare?
Yes, let's say you are.
That's very kind, thank you. Oh gosh, that's absolutely brilliant question. I think it would have to be Middlemarch, George Eliot's Middlemarch, which I think is one of the greatest novels ever written. And it's nice and long, so it would keep me going for a long time. And there's a lot in it, which I'm sure I haven't got out yet. So I'll give myself a nice leisurely reading of Middlemarch, if I may.
If you met 16-year-old version of yourself, what one piece of advice would you give yourself?
Do you know, I'd say to her, you're doing so much better than you think you are, and things are going to be all right.
And some very silly quickfire questions. Firstly, Simpsons or Futurama?
Simpsons.
Apples or oranges?
Apples.
And finally, truth or beauty?
Truth or
beauty?
Truth, every time.
Antonia Honeywell, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much indeed for having me.
This is Fab Radio International. International.
So that was the lovely Antonia Honeywell. We'll be talking about the ship in a later show. Preferably with Nympha, because I believe Nympha's already read it as well. And it's one of those ones where... slight spoiler, I didn't enjoy it as much as other people have enjoyed it, but that's me rather than the book, if you see what I'm saying. And that's kind of the point about the ship, is the ship is definitely one of those books that a lot of people will talk about,
right?
And it's almost like it's written to be talked about. So anyway, I just found the main character really annoying.
Is this going to be one of those ones that everybody on the tube's going to be reading? Because
yes.
I lived in London when The Da Vinci Code was out, and every second or third book on the tube was a Da Vinci Code.
I think it's fairer to compare it to The Beach than The Da Vinci Code. But it's one of those, if you see what I'm saying. So we're going to do another book review. So we interviewed this chap a little while ago, so let's talk about, with a voice that is often still confused but is becoming ever louder and clearer, by J.R.
It's not exactly snappy, is it?
It's not. By J.R. Hamatashkin.
Gesundheit.
Yeah. So the first story, it's an anthology. It's a short story anthology. And the first story is called Vinigstungschmerch.
Oh, we should never give you anything with languages.
Right, okay, so just getting into it. I actually quite enjoyed the anthology.
Right.
This first short story,
right.
Nope.
Okay.
No.
Back out of there.
Big bag of no. It's a body horror story. I have no problem with body horror stories. It's a body horror story that features young girls.
Oi!
It's a body horror story that features young girls and intimate body issues and existential issues. A big bag of no from me. A big bag of no from an awful lot of people who are sensitive about, you know, body issues involving young women. Based on just a stupid idea at the start, and my brain basically went, this is stupid, this is cruel, and this is mean, and no. And I, you know, went off, had a cup of tea, went back, read the next one, brilliant. You know, the rest of the stuff, you're just like, okay, well, that's a way to start. And I think it's that kind of starting your horror movie by putting a big pile of corpses in front of you and expecting you to be surprised. But yeah, for me, there's certain cut-off points where I'm just like, no, that's beyond body horror.
You've noped out of there.
Yeah, no time, stop. It's a bit like the movie Alien vs. Predator, where there's a bit in the middle where you just don't want to go there. The rest of it, though, is just, some of it's fun, some of it's weird. There's a story about a man with irritable bowel syndrome who meets a monster. There's another story about a couple on a date where monsters turn up trying to, like, essentially rip everything apart, and the guy's in that, you know, that awkward situation where you're talking to someone but you'd rather go to the toilet, but you kind of be talking to someone but you'd rather go to the toilet, you talk to someone and you kind of want everything to wrap up so you can actually spend 5 minutes of on your own.
Yeah
And then monsters turn up. Cthulhu Zombies, Ninjas and Robots is a story set in a Cthulhu convention. This guy's in a Cthulhu convention and existential horror happens. There's one which is about an author that is stalking someone on Goodreads because they want a review. It's kind of silly. I really like, all of these have really long titles. A lot of them have very, very long and silly titles. It's not terribly a bad thing. There's some really absurd bits in here. There's some really darkly horrific stuff in here. Again, there's a lot of people trying to, you know, there's a bit of Jeff Noon there. There's an awful lot of H.P. Lovecraft there. There's a bit of Philip K. Dick there. There's a bit of Alan Moore at his worst with his excesses there as well. Mm. There's a little bit of Philip K. Dick as well going on. So, is With a Voice That Is Often Still Confused But Is Becoming Ever Louder and Clearer any good? Yes, okay. It is. It's an indie book. You can tell it's an indie book because there's been no cut-off point. At no point has someone sat down and gone, no, don't do this. And sometimes that's brilliant and it really works. And sometimes you just sit there and you go, I kind of wish you had an editor there, dude. But, you know, it's that kind of, that's what we want indie books to be like. We want indie books to be a place where you can get these amazing new things coming out. So, yeah, shall we cut to the end bit of the show?
Let's cut to the end bit of the show. Vincent, you've actually used this music.
It's been a while.
It's been a while. And we have about a minute and a half now to tell you about the Folio Society collection.
So the Folio Society edition of 2001 fell onto our book reviewing desk and is currently on our TV
read. Well, it almost collapsed our book reviewing desk, so weighty and glorious was it as a book package.
Oh, it's gorgeous. It's absolutely. I mean, 2001 is a classic. Arthur C. Clarke, you should read it. You know what? We're going to use that as an excuse to review it on the show because it's come out as a Folio Society edition.
Yeah.
So let's talk about 2001. Not right now.
No, but along with that, they sent us a diary for 2016. Which is absolutely glorious, but because we now have a policy of using stuff what people send us, actually using it and writing it.
And the folio set itself, the actual 2001 book is shiny, gorgeous, full of beautiful plates, and yes, of course, there is that picture of the baby in space.
Yeah, but they also sent us the catalogue. Oh, it's book porn. It's proper book porn.
I mean, Book of
Empowers. Whatever you like, there will be something in this catalogue for you to coo over and weep silent tears as you consider the state of your bank balance and whether you need another copy of that book that you probably already own four editions of.
Have you seen a folio version of June? Oh my goodness, goodness me. What a pretty thing that is.
But I want to buy their entire catalogue, pretty much, like a good 50% of it. There's a thing about maps which looks amazing.
But it's every single genre that they're doing, every single place.
Yeah, they ain't picky. The Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury.
They're very picky, is the thing. They're very picky. They always seem to pick really, really high quality classics. But they just go everywhere when it comes to the world of genre. But yeah, Martian Chronicles, Ray Bradbury, you say? I know a song about that.
There's an entire page of Jane Austen stuff, which I'm appreciate is not particularly genre.
Does it have zombies in it?
No, but they all have slip covers.
Yeah, they all seem to have slip covers. They're very pretty. They're very pretty, shiny boobs. Slightly disappointed that 2001 didn't turn up as a black obelisk.
No.
But that would have been obvious.
And they've got Casino Royale in a slip cover.
Shall we leave?
Let's do it.
The world 24 hours a day. This is Fab Radio International.
So I have been your host, Ed Fortune.
Bookworm is a truly outrageous production for Fab Radio International and Starburst Magazine, presented by Ed Fort, produced by Anne Davis.